Beloved, let us love one another, because love is from God. Everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, for God is love. This is a profound expression of the gospel. God is love. And yet it becomes even more profound, even deeper into our reality in the next words that remind us that God's love was revealed among us in this way. God sent his only Son into the world. God was born into a body, a good and holy and harmed and human body, just like our bodies. The good news took on flesh and personality and sense of humor and all of the very human desires and passions that we've been exploring in this series, reflecting on the healthy and unhealthy manifestations of them. God took a look at human bodies and said, "That is still very good. And that is exactly where I need to be in order to show what love really lives like." Despite the miracle of the incarnation, the church, historically speaking, has not done a great job of proclaiming that bodies are good, that our bodies are where God abides with us, that our bodies are where God's love is made complete. No one has ever seen God. If we love one another, God lives in us, and God's love is perfected in us. That means God's love comes to fulfillment in us. God needs humankind in our bodies so that love can be made complete. There have been other messages about our bodies, messages of shame, of self-flagellation, of what to hide and what to deny. Many people throughout history have not been told that there is anything to celebrate about these bodies that God made good in all of our variation of size, shape, and ability. And this matters a lot when it comes to today's themes of lust and chastity, the fourth in our summer list of seven deadly sins and holy virtues. Now, this may sound a little funny, but I spent a lot of time in this week's themes. I read two entire books by Christian pastors. I don't normally have that much time. One called Shameless by Nadia Boltz Weber. One called Good Christian Sex by Bromley McClanahan. Various articles on theology, evangelical purity culture, and hookup culture. I even went to Shaw Festival to see the Canadian debut of Mae West's first play, simply and purposefully provocatively called Sex. I did research. And going to this play also prompted a long and excellent conversation with a friend about our experiences of coming of age in the church community in the early 1990s, embedded in or at least quite influenced by purity culture. We remember True Love Waits pledges and questionable youth event skits that used shame and misogyny to preach abstinence. Many overt and covert messages that still leave us in our 40s learning and unlearning much about how our sexuality is part of our creation and part of our discipleship. The deadly sin of lust is one that the church has historically chosen to obsess over, though somehow also has remained all too silent when that lust is intertwined with power and abuse and assault and harassment, particularly when committed by mostly men on pedestals of leadership and charisma. But that silence aside, the obsession with policing sexual desire has left us as Christians with an impoverished theology about the goodness of the gift of sexuality. If the conversation stops at everything is bad, how do we actually discern what is good? How do we learn about creating healthy boundaries and limits, or discerning the values that are important to us with sexual ethics, if everything is private, and therefore we come to sense probably shameful? I think this is the deadly sin we make the most private, and that leaves us at a disadvantage in finding support for living by our chosen values. Sexuality is not just sex. It is part of who we are in our embodied, diversely gendered humanity. I have heard it said that sexuality is our drive to overcome our aloneness. Ronald Rollheiser, a Catholic priest from Toronto, writes that sexuality is the hunger of the soul for wholeness, community, family, creativity, friendship, affection, and play. This hunger planted within us in creation is good. It is a gift from God. We have explored this series with the idea that the seven deadlies all begin with natural hungers of the soul, but then move toward excess, moving in a direction away from love of God and neighbor. And sex is a powerful moving force. Perhaps some of our fear springs from knowing that. Theologian Frederick Buechner writes and I had to look up the Mrs. Grundy reference. It comes from an 18th century play. Mrs. Grundy is a personification of conventional propriety. Maybe you knew that. I didn't know that. So this is his quote. "Contrary to Mrs. Grundy, sex is not sin. Contrary to Hugh Hefner, it's not salvation either. Like nitroglycerin, it can be used either to blow up bridges or heal hearts." Sexual and pornography addictions are real and often devastating problems for individuals and families. Bridges can be not only blown up but burned between people as a consequence of letting desire become lust and actions that counter our values and our commitments. Expressions of our sexuality can do harm to others and to ourselves. In Pastor Bromley McClenahan's book, Good Christian Sex, she has a chapter on a theology of vulnerability. She writes about nakedness, both literally and figuratively, saying, "The existence of sin, of everyone's capacity and inclination to do ill, renders us afraid of showing ourselves to one another. The context of our nudity, of our vulnerability, makes a difference. Some contexts, some relationships, some people are safer than others. Some reflect the joy of being free and easy, as my daughter and I describe nudity, while some are terrifying and fail to affirm our integrity or the image of God in us." She later quotes theological ethicist Karen Lebax from a book that I also have on my shelf, who writes, "Sexuality has to do with vulnerability. Eros, the desire for another, the passion that accompanies the wish for sexual expression, makes one vulnerable. It creates possibilities for great joy, but also for great suffering. To desire another, to feel passion, is to be vulnerable, capable of being wounded." We create spaces for vulnerability within any of Rollheiser's broad definition of sexuality, too, that hunger of the soul for wholeness, community, family, creativity, friendship, affection, and play. The sexuality that is part of our good creation brings us into relationship with others and into a deeper knowing of ourselves and toward a deeper communion with God. In all of this, we make ourselves vulnerable. McClenahan defines intimacy as an opening ourselves up to be changed through relationship in, we hope, holy and life-giving ways. We become vulnerable when we open ourselves up to be changed through family relationships, creative relationships, friendships, playful and sexual relationships. And though we have named the potential danger in that, there are also the richest of gifts. We heard this in 1 John. "Love has been perfected among us in this, that we may have boldness on the day of judgment. Because as Christ is, so are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear." Much of what the church has had to say about sexuality throughout history has been rooted in fear, shame, and secrecy. Certainly not boldness in our creation as whole human beings with bodies, hearts, minds, and souls, and desires that have the power to integrate them all. Teachings against lust have more often sought to divide up parts of our humanity rather than pursue wholeness. Lutheran pastor Nadia Boltz-Weber writes in her book, Shameless, that purity most often leads to pride or despair, not to holiness, because holiness is about union with, and she writes about union with God and union with others, and purity is about separation from. So how might we pursue wholeness and integration in our humanity, including our sexuality, rather than separation and division? The accompanying virtue for today is chastity. And maybe you think you know what that means and are ready for another clear line about who or what is in or out. St. Augustine, who gifted the church with some of his personal baggage about sexuality, also rather honestly and famously prayed, "Give me chastity and self-control, but not just yet." You can laugh when I say things like this. It's okay. I know we're talking about sex, but you can laugh. It's all right. McClanahan writes, "Chastity is a virtue related to temperance. It's about moderating our indulgences and exercising restraint. We're all called to exercise chastity in a variety of ways, though the details will vary given our individual situations." She contrasts this to the very specific definition of chastity within the traditional teaching of the Catholic Church, that is, restraint from sex outside of heterosexual marriage. So that's the contrast. But she continues, "But as we've spent some of these first chapters considering, there might be other norms for chastity. Maybe our marital state isn't the primary norm. I'd argue that we can be chaste, faithful, in unmarried sexual relationships if we exercise restraint. If we refrain from having sex that isn't mutually pleasurable and affirming, that doesn't respect the autonomy and sacred worth of ourselves and our partners." McClanahan spends some time discussing Margaret Farley, too, a Catholic sister who writes on Christian sexual ethics, specifically making the case for justice as an underlying principle for both love and sex. "A just love," she argues, "will have certain characteristics regardless of the type of love relationship." Our worship resource, developed by some Saskatchewan Mennonite pastors, states that chastity is not necessarily celibacy. Chastity is directing our love in appropriate ways. A chaste life leads us to put love in its right place, loving God and loving our neighbor. This is where our 1 John passage ends too. "We love because God first loved us. Those who say, 'I love God,' and hate their brothers or sisters are liars. For those who do not love a brother or sister whom they have seen cannot love God whom they have not seen. The commandment we have from God is this: those who love God must love their brothers and sisters also." This is what Jesus said when he was quizzed on the greatest commandment. "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the greatest and first commandment. And a second is like it: you shall love your neighbor as yourself." Love God, love your neighbor as you love yourself. They're inseparable. There is a good and healthy hunger in our soul to pay careful attention to steward, and to question and to discern around. It is a hunger for wholeness, community, family, creativity, friendship, affection, and play. It shows up in our attractions and ideas and passions and desires that can lead us in beautiful, relational, faithful, and creative paths. We need to steward these movements and openings in our souls, though, to continually ask, "Am I loving God? Am I loving my neighbor? And, yes, myself?" Two of the resources I looked at this week suggested questions to ask ourselves as we develop a sexual ethic or think about sexual stewardship, in Nadia Boltz-Weber's words. I've posted links online already with my sermon. You can find them there. Starting the conversation from what values are most important to you can be a more fruitful beginning point than what's the list of do's and don'ts. A values conversation creates space for those we trust and who we invite into this conversation to inquire of us, for example, in the beliefs, values, and practices that you are developing regarding your sexuality, is your relationship with God flourishing? Or how is this choice you are making helping you to be in alignment with your values? Does this experience bring you or your partner more deeply into the moment, the sacred, into your bodies, or is it separating either of you from these things? Lust is not the same thing as attraction, chemistry, or desire, because lust actually separates us from our humanity and the humanity of others. Lust can do harm before it even becomes an outward action. If it changes the way in which we respect another person as an autonomous human being, sexualizing them from afar. Lust can do harm in relationships if we are unable to honestly name the hungers in our souls that we have covenanted with a partner to either share or walk away from. Lust is not too much love. It is not enough love. Philosopher Simon Blackburn says, "Love is individual. There is only the unique other, the doted upon, the single star around whom the lover revolves. Lust takes what comes." So McClenahan writes, "The question of lust isn't necessarily just one of monogamy then. It's about the failure to value someone for who they are in the fullness of their humanity." She continues with the definition, "Lust is sinful because it devalues others as individuals. Lust isn't really concerned with the particulars of another, about his body or her interest or her consent. Lust is sinful because it fails the test of neighbor love, but it can also fail the test of self-love too." Lust is not too much love, it is not enough love. It is not enough love for the whole of our humanity, hearts and minds embedded in bodies and endowed with souls. We and our neighbors are each on this journey toward wholeness. God's love made whole and complete in us, in our emotions, our sensations, and our dreams. Beloved, since God loved us so much, we also ought to love one another as whole people. Not only physical bodies and not only minds, but as the family of God in whom God abides and to whom God has given the Spirit. A fire which has the power to blow up bridges or to heal hearts has been kindled within us by the God of creation. Let us pray for the strength and the grace and, yes, the joy to tend that fire, that it might warm and light and guide other pilgrims on the way of wholeness. This is the prayer that we will sing together now. Within our darkest night, you, God, kindle a fire that never dies away. It's number 10 in your Voices Together booklet. And we'll sing it through a few times. The last time will be a cappella, so that will be your cue that it's the last time through. I will lead it through the first time and then sit down and we'll continue singing. And you can stay seated for this one and reflect on the fire that is kindled within us and how we steward this in God's love. Let's pray this song.
Within our darkest night.